So.
All right. Welcome today to the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development, and it's March 14th, 2013. Thanks for everybody taking your time to be here with us. We have two bills up today for public hearings. We'll start with Senate Bill 578, and we'll have a short explanation, and then we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 578. Explanation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 578 prohibits a person from harvesting wild mushrooms without a wild mushroom harvesting permit. It requires persons selling or purchasing wild mushrooms for resale to hold a wild mushroom dealer permit, and it authorizes the Oregon Department of Agriculture to establish permits and adopt rules to regulate harvesting of wild mushrooms and dealing in wild mushrooms. We also have a proposed dash one amendment that you should have in front of you and is also in the back there for the audience if they'd like to look at it. I can go into depth about that one if you'd like, but I can.
Good.
Okay. So the dash one amendment prohibits a person from harvesting wild mushrooms for resale without a commercial wild mushroom harvester license issued by ODA, except when the harvester is a landowner of the property. It prohibits the purchase of wild edible mushrooms for resale unless the person holds a commercial wild mushroom buyer license and mushrooms are purchased from a licensed commercial wild mushroom harvester or from the landowner. It also authorizes ODA to establish fees for the licenses, and it maintains the requirement that a person obtain a written permit from the landowner to harvest products, and that the person transporting special forest products possess a written permit or document for sale, of sale, except it excludes the cutting or transportation of no more than 1 gallon of wild edible mushrooms at harvest for purposes other than resale and commercial harvesting by a licensed wild mushroom harvester. So those are the key parts of that amendment as well.
Okay, and with that, we'll have...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Point of clarification, because my reading of the dash one amendment appears to be what we would commonly call a gut and stuff.
It's pretty much a complete change, yeah.
Okay, just want that for the record.
That's that's really good to say. I should have said that, too. That's why we read the dash ones. The idea came, and then we got a lot of input from a lot of different people, so that's when we started drafting amendments to make it, and it became clear that the new thing was more than the original, so it's pretty much changed. So thank you very much for that clarification. So with that, we'll have Jack Sardinicki. Okay, thank you. Al King and John Getz. These long names just make it hard for me.
Mr. Chair, just for those who may not know who Al King is, we may want to just let everyone know he is a former state representative.
Yes, he is.
Served out of the Springfield area.
Yep. Thank you. I noticed that Jenny was a lot more excited about seeing Jack than she was about me, and I know her from college. So.
Well, yeah. There's a reason for that. Starts with a T, ends in an E.
I was good.
Yes. So whoever wants to start, thank you.
Yeah, my name's Jack Czarnecki.
Yep.
I'm the founder of the Joel Palmer House. I have written 3 books on cooking with wild mushrooms over the last 20 years. I moved to Oregon from Pennsylvania 16 years ago, and I have foraged and used more wild mushrooms and truffles than any other chef in the United States. So I spent a little bit of time in the woods, and I'm here to support Bill 578, Amendment Dash 1. And I just want to recount a couple of private observations that I've had to support my position on this. I'll mention them, and then I'll summarize it very quickly. I won't take too much of your time. I've been in the woods on a number of occasions where I have seen wild mushrooms misidentified. And although people will tell you that they're well known and they're many of them are unmistakable, I sat in front of a House committee hearing back in 1999, which made the chanterelle, the state mushroom of Oregon. In fact, there are 2 other lookalikes, one of which is definitely poisonous, and the other one, which is suspicious, specifically the jack-o'-lantern and the Cantharellus flaccosus, which I have seen in the buckets of people who have purported or claimed to be commercial harvesters. So this is something that's of great concern to me, being in the restaurant business, that what a chef gets, he knows to be reliable. Item number two, the observation which is even more disturbing. 2 years ago, I happened by a stand on a major highway where there's a large sign that said Morels. So I said, oh, that's interesting, and I stopped by. And I knew who the distributor was. And what, in fact, he was selling was a mushroom that looks like a morel, but it's not a morel, something called a verba.
Javi, get back away from the microphone. These are too sensitive, so push it ahead of, push it away from you.
Okay.
It picks up too easily.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. That's perfect.
So anyway, he was purporting to sell morels. In fact, he was selling these verpas, and there was some suspicion as to the edibility of verpas. They're also referred to as early spring morels, but he was selling them as morels. It was a different mushroom. Now, either he was intentionally being deceitful, which is his business if he wants to do that, but more disturbing is the possibility that this person, this is not a harvester, this is a person who is actually a distributor and distributes to restaurants, didn't know the difference himself. Observation number three is that over the last several years, I have noticed an increase in the number of camps being occupied by a large number of harvesters in central and western Oregon, particularly in South Beach, where they bring in vans from California in particular, and they park there for weeks at a time. Other vans come up, take the porcini in this case, and take them back, and they pretty much occupy that area. And all their detritus and slop and everything like that pretty much stays. This is beginning to happen, has been happening for the last few years also in central Oregon, particularly in the area around Bend and Sisters, where there's been an increasing number of harvesters, many of them coming from out of state, who have decided that this is where the best mushrooming is, so they're going to harvest. What is beginning to become troublesome is that a lot of these large bands, and they are quite organized, are beginning to move into western Oregon, particularly along the coast, and I'll defer to my friend John Goetz, who'll talk about that a little bit more. So, and I'll read the statement in conclusion. Besides the safety issues, Oregon's newly recognized reputation as a destination for culinary tourism, which has been supported both by our last governor and our current governor, is being threatened by an enormous influx of harvesters, many of whom may have little or no training in the activity of commercial mushroom harvesting, and who wantonly trample our precious environment while absconding with one of our most treasured resources. And to this committee, I say to you gentlemen, ladies, enough is enough. Thank you.
Hi, Al King from Springfield. And I had the pleasure of going mushroom hunting with Jack and, you know, witnessed some of the things. And I'm not skilled. I'm not a mushroom person, but I also got to go truffle hunting with him recently, and in the conversation he was saying that there was trouble in mushroom land, and that you know, a number of places, you know, are being harvested pretty hard, that people that are Oregon harvesters, I think you're going to hear from some, you know, from some today, really are very careful and, you know, treat the land well. But, you know, some of the people that come from out of state and think they may never, ever be back again, you know, don't necessarily use those kind of practices. And so I thought it would be worthwhile to contact, you know, my senator, Lee Beyer, and ask for a bill to be introduced, and he introduced me to you, and so we got this started, and so we appreciate the opportunity here. We have been working to function, you know, kind of as a working group to get input, you know, into the bill, and you know want to continue to do that. And there are some people in the room that would like to have input, and we'd like to share with that the intent of the bill is to not disturb recreational family harvesters. they're completely left out of the process. The concern is that if the current pressures continue to build, that 10 years from now we may not have mushrooms to, you know, to harvest in Oregon, and that what we need to do is to take some process so we can get a handle on, you know, what it is and have, you know, good sustainable practices, you know, in Oregon. And so what we, you know, looked at doing as, you know, some that seemed to be the best answer would be to have licenses for the people that are doing it commercially, you know, including, you know, the commercial, you know, buyers. And that, you know, that would provide some revenue so that the state could, you know, take some time and see what kind of administration, what it, enforcement might be needed if, you know, if and when. My suspicion is at some point in time that, you know, likely would occur. And that it'd be a shame if we didn't do something now and then 10 years from now we look back and say, we really have, you know, obvious trouble. It would have been nice if we'd done some before. In all fairness, some people are, you know, would be looking and saying, well, what's going on in the mushroom bill? And that I had my experience with Jack not long before the legislative session. And so it's not something that's been worked for 2 years and, you know, got wide input on. And, you know, we want to include that, you know, process. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is John Getz, Senator Roblin, and the committee. I live in Florence, Oregon, and I'm the president of an Oregon Wild Mushroom and Truffle Association. We're a group of diverse interests in this group and pertaining to the wild fungi here in Oregon. And we're a new association seeking a 501c6 status. I've been a commercial harvester for 28 years and a wild mushroom recreational harvester for 36 years. And I've traveled and hunted all types of mushrooms throughout Oregon and Northern California since 1987. I've witnessed the before and after effects of the wild mushroom industry as vast areas were transformed into intense commercial harvesting operations. And along with those impacts, both social and environmental, I was quoted in the New Yorker magazine, in addition, August 20th, 2007, on page 65, where I explained this transformation that took place in Central Oregon on 9/15/1989, and that was the last day I picked amongst herds of elk. For 2.5 years, it was like heaven on earth, but the influx was immediate, literally overnight. And the impacts on the wildlife have been severe. I do not believe that any long-term sustainable wild mushroom resource can be obtainable without a balance of animal coexistence with commercial harvesters. I see a great opportunity here to finally professionalize the wild mushroom industry through licensing and hopefully through certification. Wise planning is essential to create an atmosphere where the maximum value of these resources can be realized. Due to the social dynamic structure and the nature of this resource, it's virtually impossible for enforcement to ensure that people follow the rules and the guidelines. Western Oregon is not a vast land waiting to be explored. You know, like Central Oregon and Southern Oregon was 20 years ago, there was a lot of areas that, you know, would provide an opportunity for a lot of these large groups of out-of-staters who are poised and ready to come into Western Oregon. And for example, knowing where to, well, I'm sorry. Keep in mind that the local harvesters have years of intimate understanding of these areas that they've picked for many years is very key as well, because you know where to step, where not to step, and you know the succession of the fruitings. And that's with a minimal impact, that's the most effective way to really be sustainably and stewardshiply harvesting this resource. And Western Oregon, you know, our soils in Western Oregon are much softer than, say, the soils in the mountain areas in Central Oregon, so we can't handle the high traffic and the impact of harvesters. another influx of influx, large influx of out-of-state harvesters is certainly going to create some social tensions and demise of our crop and result in lots of revenue leaving our state and local communities where people have been accustomed and enjoyed these things for a long time. Mushroom companies tend to believe that more mushroom pickers means more mushrooms, when in fact the opposite is true. More harvesters with little understanding of the fruiting patterns and locations will result in more soil compaction, human waste, erosion, and trampled mushrooms. When the resource suffers, everybody loses. And in 1992, my great concerns for this resource and the possibility of the Forest Service management was likely to be scaled way back. It led me to act. In 1993, I took out a group of scientists from OSU and some Forest Service personnel to one of my favorite Matsutake areas. And on this outing, a botanist explained to me that Washington, D.C. was going to cut off their funding. And because the timber industry was pretty much, if we all remember when Clinton was elected, his forest plan. And so they needed a ways to inventory. And it was just recently realized in 89 that how much money was in the Matsutake. So they were, you know, they were offered, if they just needed to inventory this, and which seemed overwhelming. And I said, there's a plant right there. And I've used that to scout the entire state in Northern California. And it's symbiotic. It lives exclusively on Matsutake. You can find it year-round with 100% certainty. And the forest people out in the woods can just GPS, and you got your map, it worked, they got new rigs in 2 months. And my fears of an out-of-control industry running wild without forest management were at ease, so I got what I wanted. And to ensure stewardship and crafting of a permit system with in the Oregon dunes, you know, my efforts there for 20 years have been focused on the dunes. And I think we've done a really good job. And then we hit a little bump in 2009, so I created an association of harvesters. And we collaboratively worked with the Forest Service. We invited them to our meetings, and it worked. And we came up with something that was perceived as a successful outcome by both sides. I was also a member of the OHV designated routes that was going on in the dunes, where they had to designate routes for the 10C areas, and that lasted about 2 years. But I've just always engaged myself, and I really love these resources, and I thank you for taking this into consideration very much. And that's it.
Any questions for this panel? Okay, Senator Berkshire.
Oh, I'm up first. So I think first of all, Mr. Getz, you refer to, you know, wildlife habitat being destroyed and compaction of the soils. And are those your observations, or is that from a study we can point to?
They've done studies in Chemul, and it was pretty much on the raking, deep raking, and they concluded that deep raking has an effect. What I have witnessed myself, long-term observations, is I suspect soil compaction is more of an impact, where the mushrooms are pretty much a fruit of an organism, and their job is basically to reproduce another colony. They're not like grass seeds spread in grass that fall right into place. And the soil compaction, especially in the dunes habitat, it's just like if you're walking on the beach in the surf line, you look at your feet when the sand's wet and you see the water leave and you see these white rings. And that goes on in the dunes, and I've seen this in areas that were highly productive where there's high traffic, that the crops have tailed off. But these are just my views as far as scientific study. That still has just to be done to really substantiate that. It's just an observation.
Follow it?
Oh.
So this could go to any of the three on the panel. How would this bill help prevent these concerns? How would it do that?
Part of the concept here is that the agencies really are not involved in what happens with mushrooms currently, and that this would start a process where they're able to you know, have a little revenue to be able to you know, fund taking a look at it, and the agencies would be able to talk about, well, what rules are there, how big, you know, is the market, what's the size, the activities that's there, and that then, you know, over some time and interagency cooperation, they'll get a better handle on how to, you know, to work with, you know, seeing that, you know, that the mushroom resource is, you know, is well maintained. And so that once they have some understanding of how to work with the resource and how to cooperate with each other, and then to whatever degree, you know, is necessary, you know, have some revenue base and be able to be involved in enforcement to whatever degree, you know, would be necessary. So it kind of start the rulemaking process and start the really the product knowledge and the sharing of information and how to work together process for the agencies.
I'd like to add to that too as well. This type, the nature of this resource is like, it's almost virtually impossible to enforce, at least how it is now with the landowners granting the permission, and most of the rules can be broken out in the woods. It does provide an opportunity for the buy stations, which are easily for, they usually have a state policeman and a Forest Service visit these stations. I see with a state license, and I've talked with the Forest Service and asked them if they would, and they said yes, require in issuing the permits that an individual gets first acquires a state mandated license before they're given the permit. This would save a fortune on enforcement because then they can't sell the mushrooms in the buy station without the license issued by the state. It's the same with the permit, but having the two together, it's just ultimately down the road, if we got rid of the cash on the street, that would really clean things up. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So working with agencies together, man, I'm so sorry.
Well, what I would want to add also is that currently the revenue leaves the state. You know, no one really knows how much the crop is worth totally and how much of it, you know, is sold in the state. But most of these mushrooms are being sold in Asia. And, you know, a big part of the harvest is by people who do not live in the state. So they harvest our mushrooms. You know, they take their revenue back to California, and then the mushrooms leave Oregon. And so we could really lose our resource over time without getting any, you know, Oregon enjoyment benefit from that. So
I'd just like to reiterate what I said about the safety issue. That is not in place in 578 as it exists right now. Just to clarify, a permit as it exists is simply the right for someone to harvest mushrooms. You walk into a ranger station, you put down your money, you get a license, or you get a permit, rather. So it allows you to pick. What a license does is it requires, and if you look at the Dash 1 amendment, it refers quite a bit to a licensing procedure, which at some time in the near future will come into being, which will, in fact, definitively identify individuals who can successfully identify mushrooms so that they can go out and then commercially harvest. I've cited three different species of mushrooms in my earlier testimony, which are often mistaken and can be easily mistaken for mushrooms which can be quite toxic.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Al, my understanding from your testimony, you contacted the chair to put this in motion because I was trying to figure out where the bill actually started. So
yes.
Understanding that, I understand also this work group is to wanting to have people come in and be part of it. I can tell you I've received emails from individuals, and it's interesting to see in, on the amendments that have been received. Mr. Goetz, one of your colleagues, Charlie Lefevre, is a very good friend of mine. I know of his work, and I know that they contacted me because at first they didn't know what this bill was. They just heard, and they thought it was going to be pretty devastating. Can you tell us today if Charlie is actually on board with what the Dash 1s propose?
Yeah, I've had one conversation with him since. I don't even know if he's back from Spain now, so I haven't had an opportunity to really talk in depth. But once I explained to him that we're just pretty much addressing the commercial activity, he, at first, yes, he was very concerned. He was also concerned about certification getting into harvest techniques, especially particularly with truffles, which is something, I mean, I use a dog, it's my choice. I don't take sides on the issue. There is such thing as responsible rakers. That was one thing that I, from my feedback, he was a little concerned on that. Feels, you know, the dog should evolve on its own, and I totally agree. But I just shared with him that I haven't had a chance to talk to with him lately and give him an up-to-date where we've come to this point with the amendment. So.
And so part of what I said in that, you know, the bill kind of happened pretty quickly, and so it's really understandable that a lot of people that are interested in mushroom are concerned about what is this bill about. And that when we have worked on this, we really want the table to be an open table so people can put input into the process, and that we've really bookended it so that this is trying to get a handle on really the commercial harvesting side, and particularly people that are coming in from, you know, in an almost an inundation, you know, from out of state, you know, on the resource. So we're really leaving the family recreational harvester, you know, out of the process. I want to get a handle on what's happening, you know, on the commercial side.
Follow. So I guess my concern is that this seems like it's come on the scene very quickly for a lot of people. I understand that there may be some type of work group. In my reading of the bill or the dash ones, I don't see that in there as to establishing a work group. And I'm not saying we need to do that first, but at the same time, I know this is only for public hearing, and I'd like to have more information before I'm able to actually vote on it as to what the plan is. I've worked with Charlie in trying to get our ag agency to actually work with him and the ventures of Joel Palmer House as to how things should be done in this state, how we can actually capitalize on the truffles. And, of course, there's other wild mushrooms that are very prominent here. But knowing on the truffle side, we have native white and black truffles.
Yep.
And there's not too many places that can actually say that. I know the pecan truffles, which, you know,
we're
has a little southern bell to it.
We're it.
Yeah, and so it's one of those things that I think that we should be promoting. And to me, and I understand with the great food that I've had at Joel Palmer House, that you can actually see another market and venture just like the wine industry has done. And so I'm very conscious of that, and I want to be cautious that we're not somehow going to rush to something. And I also have to acknowledge that the commercial activities, from what I've heard from different people that do harvest, can be overwhelming, and they are, in fact, as the chair is mentioning to me before we started, physical altercations that are occurring out there, and turf, etc. So those are just some of the things I just want to put on the record, so we'll have other people testifying. Maybe they can address some of that as well.
And we agree with that, and we're not an official work group. If you want to have an official work group, you know, that would be great. But we are operating and are welcoming to continue operating as if we were that, so good discussion can occur.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator.
Mr. Chair. And I also have taken advantage of Mr. Chernocki's mushrooms, and I'm always very appreciative, extremely appreciative, that he knows what he's doing when he picks these mushrooms, because all I know is they taste good and they don't kill me. But my question is, you had mentioned that, you know, seeing new mushroom stands where the mushrooms were the wrong kind. Are you aware of circumstances where people have actually gotten some of the poisonous ones by accident, or have marketed them, or have tried to market them?
Well, the example I used was of something called an early spring morel, which is not a real morel. Sometimes modifiers are used to give you an idea that they're simply modifiers of an existing type of species. An early spring morel is not a morel. It's a different genus called a verpa. Verpa is not deadly. There's some question as to whether or not it's toxic. The settlement has pretty much come down on the fact that if you ate too many of them, you could get quite sick. But the fact of the matter is, it is a different variety from what was being sold. It's more intense with a chanterelle, because there is something called a jack-o'-lantern that looks almost exactly like a chanterelle, which is definitely poisonous. Fortunately, in Oregon, it's not as prevalent as it is, say, in California. But the opportunity and the possibility for poisoning is quite stark in California, and is possibly, you know, there in Oregon as well. I could give you other examples. The whole issue here is competence and knowledge from the people who are harvesting the mushrooms and the truffles, but particularly the mushrooms, because their identification becomes the bigger issue. But secondly, it's the issue of the competence of the distributors. and they need to know, and they need to be licensed. And most of them do know, and they're, you know, they're fine. But there are some that aren't. I gave you one example of one who simply didn't, and maybe he didn't know. Maybe he was being, maybe he thought it was a morel. But it's disturbing, and this is just one instance, and one seller. So that's my concern. It kind of gets back to the safety issue, and I think this needs to be some oversight. It's been said that it's a self-regulating industry, in that you're not going to sell poisonous mushrooms to somebody. But what if a guy has a family and he sends out his 14-year-old son and daughter to go pick mushrooms, and they come back with something that looks like a straw mushroom that you buy in a can and turns out to be Amanita phalloides? Might sound extreme, but every year in California, there are usually Asians, and it's usually half a dozen to a dozen of them who actually die from eating Amanita phalloides because it looks exactly like a straw mushroom. It's a mushroom you'll see in a stir fry in a Chinese restaurant. They look exactly alike when they're young. And if someone is not extremely careful, I mean, that is an instance in which a deadly poisonous mushroom can obviously do you a lot of harm. Someone who does this and understands identification of mushrooms would know immediately. It's not difficult to do, but there needs to be some level of licensing to ascertain that these people know what they're doing.
Right, and that's why I'm glad this bill is before us, and I'm also glad wearing my hat as the Finance and Revenue Director that it sounds like we're losing a high-value crop, possibly in large volumes.
I think that's really the big issue, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We want our mushrooms and truffles for Oregonians.
Yes, especially me.
I see no other questions. Thank you very much for coming forward. Next, we're going to have Carl Wilmanson, Northwest Forest Worker Center, Ralph Siegfried, and Rick Pine. And as people know, when we call people up, we do it. We look at how far they've come, and we look at for, against, and neutral kind of thing. So we get a cross-section, so everybody knows how we're doing this. And who signed up first, so you guys were that group.
I believe
you did. You called me first, so.
Yep.
Okay, I'm Carl Wilmson, Executive Director of the Northwest Forest Worker Center, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for giving me the opportunity to speak today on Senate Bill 578. The Northwest Forest Worker Center, we just recently changed our name. We were formerly known as the Alliance of Forest Workers and Harvesters, and it has been a registered nonprofit organization in the state of Oregon since 1998. We empower forest workers and harvesters of non-timber forest products, including mushrooms, in Oregon, Northern California, and Washington to have a voice in forest management decisions that directly affect their lives and livelihoods. We support efforts to assure sustainability of non-timber forest products and other forest resources, but we feel that Senate Bill 578 does not accomplish that objective. There are two major problems with the bill. First, Senate Bill 578 will have a disproportionate impact on low-income harvesters, especially harvesters who are legal immigrants from Southeast Asia. For the record, I would like to point out the reasons why immigrants from Laos, Cambodia, and other Southeast Asian countries ended up here in the United States earning a living by harvesting wild mushrooms and other non-timber forest products. Simply, the reason is it's because they fought on our side in the Vietnam War. After the fall of Saigon in 1975, the Viet Cong and the army of the new communist regime in Laos began systematically slaughtering whole families of Hmong and Mien people who are minority groups in Southeast Asian countries and who were our allies during the war. The people had little choice but to flee to refugee camps in neighboring Thailand. And there, families waited often for many years before finding American families that would sponsor them so that they could come and start a new life in America. Once they got here, however, starting all over again was not easy. Traditionally, the Hmong and Mien people did not live in a market economy. They made a living from the land, practicing Swidden agriculture and hunting and fishing and gathering wild foods. These were the skills that they had when they arrived here in America. Not speaking English, not having skills that were needed in a market economy, the market economy of the United States, and often facing discrimination, the people turned to what they knew, earning a living from the land. And because this is the way they made a living in their native countries, they happened to be very good at harvesting wild mushrooms and other non-timber forest products. Now, in 2013, many of these harvesters know no other work in America. They have no other source of income. To suddenly start charging them for state mushroom harvesting licenses would impose a real hardship on them. The profit margin on mushroom harvesting is small, especially now that the price of gasoline is getting so high. The harvesters buy permits from the Forest Service already. They pay camping fees and they pay for gasoline because they drive around a lot going to the different harvesting areas. In addition, more and more areas are being put off limits to mushroom picking due to logging, setting aside land for other purposes, and protection for endangered species habitat. The land area on many national forests where mushroom harvesting is permitted in Oregon is shrinking. This, too, cuts into the annual incomes of harvester families. And I repeat, imposing another licensing fee on harvesters will have a significant impact on them. The second major problem with Senate Bill 578 is that it's discriminatory. I have been told, and we just heard the testimony of former state representative Al King, that the intent of this bill is to deal with intense mushroom harvest and destructive practices of out-of-state harvesters who have the potential to damage future mushrooming opportunities for Oregonians. Now, we at the Northwest Forest Workers Center recognize that there are problems with some harvesters engaging in unsustainable harvest practices, such as raking, which was mentioned in the previous testimony. The center has had a citizen-based monitoring program in place for monitoring the Matsutake harvest in Oregon's Central Cascades for over 10 years. Part of the program is educating mushroom pickers about sustainable harvest practices. Because of our advocacy, the Forest Service outlawed the use of long tools in harvesting mushrooms many years ago. Unfortunately, despite our efforts, unsustainable practices still happens, and I'm not going to deny that. But there is no evidence that indicates that out-of-state harvesters are the ones who are responsible for damage to the resource. It is just as likely that residents of Oregon also rake mushroom beds. There simply is no data on who is doing the raking. Furthermore, there is no data on how many harvesters in Oregon are from out of state. Simply put, this bill is attempting to address a problem based on hearsay. In so doing, it discriminates against out-of-state harvesters, many of whom happen to be immigrants from Southeast Asia. The bill is discriminatory in another way. It exempts firewood cutters who have permits to cut firewood on federal lands from the Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management from having to buy licenses from the state. But it does not provide this exemption to mushroom harvesters. So this is discriminatory. Moreover, there's a history of racial profiling by the Oregon State Police and by Forest Service officers in some ranger districts during mushroom harvest seasons. If this bill is passed, it is likely that racial profiling by law enforcement officers will become an even greater problem for harvesters of color. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we'll do the whole panel, and then we'll come back for questions.
Ralph Siegfried, thank you. I've been in the mushroom business since 1984. It was good business. Then in the 90s, the state passed a law to control U-wood and tag mushrooms onto it. With a little or no input from people in the business. And that's the law we have now. Well, the volumes of mushrooms was cut by more than half because the timber companies did not want to deal with pickers or the liability of permits. So they said no permits, and we were shut off of them. Now you want to make it even harder for us, pickers and buyers. There are laws on the books now. They are not enforced. And why don't we do more to enforce them? All the picking in the world doesn't do the damage one day of logging does. Just doesn't. You log it, they're gone. The timber companies lock up public land so we can't get to it and then complain when we pick mushrooms on their land. We already need permits from the feds, state, private, and now a license from the state. Give me a break. What you are doing here is wrong. You should be helping the small guys, not the big timber companies. You should be passing laws like no one can block access to public land ever. In the early 90s, you could drive in the hills for days and never see a gate. Now you can't go 5 miles and not see one, and half the land behind those lock gates is public. Why can private companies control so much public land? I thought BLM belonged to the people. Stop the timber companies, or as the Oregon Fish and Wildlife call them, industrial landowners, from spraying the herbicide they are using. This stuff is god-awful. It kills everything, except fir trees, and sometimes even them. Elk and deer are starving in the middle of clear cuts where most of their food used to be. There is no biodiversity anymore, and I don't believe mushrooms will ever grow where the spray has been used. The timber companies are the bad guys here, not pickers and buyers. These are people trying to feed their families. They are not making a lot of money. If they make minimum wage, they're doing good. Any one of them would trade what they make for what you make. There are laws in the books. Enforce them. Don't make more.
I don't know what you mean.
They would. Even better yet, take those laws off the books and go back to where it was. We've been in this business for more than 30 years and know how to take care of the forest and the mushrooms. I've never lost a mushroom bed to overpicking, only to logging. What you should be doing is making the timber companies open their roads to public land year-round, or better yet, open their land year-round to hunting, fishing, trapping, mushroom picking, or lose their timber deferrals. My property taxes are higher to offset their deferrals, so I might as well get something out of it. And as far as this not affecting weekend, I have a lot of weekenders bringing me mushrooms. They go out to make extra Christmas money. The kids pick to make extra spending money. This would hurt them more than anything. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, my name is Rick Pine. Thank you for your time, Senators and Administrator. I'm from Washington. I've been in the business of harvesting mushrooms for over 20-plus years, and I've seen both sides of the coin. I've seen it as a picker, per se, and now I own my own business, and it's a sole proprietorship. I do probably 80% of my business in the state of Oregon, even though I'm in Washington. I sell to your restaurants, and some of the testimony today stated that your revenue from these buyers is going out of the state of Oregon. That is incorrect. I would love to see the data on how much money actually leaves the state of Oregon versus how much money stays in the state of Oregon. As a picker, we all pay for our license fees, our transportation, our gas, our food, and it's all in this state. When we sell to the buyer, then the buyer actually has to go somewhere with that product, and that is to the companies. I can name probably 8 different companies in the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon has their sales tax, or not sales tax, they have property taxes, they have business taxes, they have it all. So where is that testimony stating that the money is leaving Oregon? It's not. The only income that is being lost is through the transfer of mushrooms illegally, meaning that the police, the state troopers, the sheriff's office aren't doing enough out there to protect the true pickers, the honest pickers. It's the people that are picking illegally without permits. That's where your loss is coming from. I've been in the business for 20 years. I've been checked by state, both states, Washington and Oregon. They come in, they check my buy station. I have a control book. They check everything to make sure that I'm checking the people that are out there being honest. If they send somebody into a buy station that doesn't have permits, that's on me. That's on the buyer. So now with this new bill that's being trying to pass, not only do I have to do state enforcement laws as an individual that don't get paid by the state, but now you want me to do not only another $500 fee for me to commercially pick, another $1,500 to buy a mushroom in the state of Oregon. And all that revenue stays here. But I sell to 9 different restaurants in Portland area alone. That's all revenue for this, for Oregon, not Washington. And I don't see where some testimony is saying that these people are over-harvesting. I've been in the business for 20 years. I do public land. I do private timber company land. I do national forest land. I've seen it for 20-plus years, and I have never seen a devastation of over-harvest. There is what we've seen in the past couple of years is less mushrooms, and it's not due to over-harvest. It's due to climate, water loss. This extreme heat we had last summer stopped the whole process of the mycelium base growing during its natural time to grow during the summer, so you have your fall mushrooms. If there's an extreme heat wave, they know that, and it's documented that it will kill the mycelium base. I also wanted to state that they were saying that as a buyer or a business, they want to hold us more accountable. I don't know any business out there that doesn't already carry a $2 million liability policy, because that's on us. If I sell a mushroom to any person, any restaurant, the city of Portland has certificates for me in every one of my restaurants. I name exactly what mushroom I sell to them. They keep that on file for 90 days. If there is anybody who gets sick, they'll come back to the restaurant. Then it comes back to me. We find out what happened. There is none of this about, well, he sold this mushroom, you know, because it wasn't identified right. There's no certification, no class that you can take. You can go to the colleges. You can go through mushroom classes. But anybody out there can pick a wrong mushroom. Anybody can pick a chanterelle and eat 50 pounds and not have a problem. Their child can eat one mushroom and have an allergic reaction to it. There's no database stating that any mushroom can be toxic to anybody, because it can. It's a fungus. If a chanterelle is in the wild and you have a elk, a deer, any kind of varmint that may urinate, may defecate on that mushroom, you don't know that. You sell that mushroom to a restaurant, somebody gets sick on it. Was it the mushroom that was misidentified? No. It was off of feces. We all know that rats, mice carry defecated feces. So that's something else that nobody takes in consideration of what we do as buyers and mushroom pickers. I just think this bill that they're trying to pass is going to impact the little guy more than anybody, especially a sole proprietor that this is my livelihood. I can't afford to pay another $2,000 on top of something that I've already paid for the National Forest, timber company's property, transfer permits. I meant Washington, we have transfer permits from one area to the other area. We don't need another cost. We just need people to do their jobs at the buy stations to monitor all the commercial people that are actually commercial harvesting to sell. because you can go in the wilderness and I can pick 5,000 pounds of morels if I wanted to. There's no license fee. There's nothing. Because in the wilderness, you are allowed to do that. But you just can't leave the wilderness with that product. That's a catch. That's true. And that's where the police departments and the state has to get together. I mean, when they put the liability on the buyers to start checking everybody's licenses, it did. It helped out probably 30%, 35%. But there's still some of those buyers that don't go by what the law says, and they don't check because they've known the people for 5, 10, 20 years. And I've known people that come up to my buy station, you don't have it? I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Krasanski.
So a couple of you have talked about fees, and I wonder if you could just share with us the fees. I understand we don't have a fee yet. That's what is proposed, not to exceed $100 for a harvester, not to exceed $500 for a buyer. But it sounds like the feds may have some type of a fee, and also does Washington State, could you elaborate?
Washington State does not have a fee. The National Forest does. The timber companies, some of them you can go in and get contracts with them, not only mushroom, salal, bear grass, and wood cutting, it's all that. But we have a program over there, which is the DNR, which is Department of Natural Resources, that monitors everything that moves in the state of Washington. In that state, we are required to have what they call a transfer permit. That is, if we're set up to buy in Randall, Washington, and we move that product from Randall, Washington to Seattle, we have to have that permit. We have to have it to move it 5 feet out of that buy station.
Here in Oregon, you have to have a permit to pick mushrooms unless you're doing it personally. Yes. It either has to be a landowner, state forestry, or the feds, BLM, or Forest Service. And it just depends on how many mushrooms you can pick. Federal, you can get them for Forest Service, $100 for the seed. BLM, it's like 10 cents a pound. And state forestry, I don't deal with them a lot, but high too. So you're losing probably 50% of what you're getting for those mushrooms paying for them in permits. And you have to have a permit to transport them on the road. Okay. This is all law. It's in the law. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Stuck through.
Yeah, and we have a BLM person said he'd come, so we can ask that question. They're neutral on the whole thing, but they would be glad to answer the question too.
But and then again, BLM only gives out, I mean, they may have 50 sections, and they'll only let you pick from three or four.
All right. Well, let me just follow up if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
So you said 10 cents per pound, and I'm not sure if that's for a specific type of chanterelles. And chanterelles, when you sell your, what is the going price? I know it changes for year to year. And
it could be 50 cents to $1.50.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator, I can elaborate a little bit when it comes to private timber companies, because they do what they call a percentage. And if any mushroom, let's say it sells for a dollar, my company that I deal with, they want 20% of the market value. In other words, if I was to sell it, not to a restaurant, but to a buyer. So each mushroom is costing me a certain amount, and the timber companies are actually the one that I deal with.
There's a lot of them out there.
Yes, they can make a lot of money in years that there's a lot of harvesting, but then again, they have problems with people getting on the properties and not having permits, because most of your timber companies do not release permits. They do contracts.
Okay.
And not only you were talking about the fees, but then as a buyer or a sole proprietorship, I still have to have a state license too. I have to have, you know, $2 million liability policy if I sell a mushroom. Gotcha. And that's what every business does.
Okay.
And just another $2,000 on top of that every year to me, because I'm out of state, That would devastate my sole proprietorship.
Could I add one more thing?
One quick one, because we've got about twenty people left out there that want to say.
We're totally dependent on the weather. One year we may have a bumper crop, the next year there may not be any mushrooms at all. Yeah. This year I didn't buy a mushroom because of the weather. We're like farmers, but we can't get insurance like farmers do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And we'll keep your names together, because if we do put a group together, I assume you would be interested.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, that's good. So next we're going to invite Fred Shipley and Ron, is it Exter. Come on, just for a second. I know. And Ron, we asked Ron to come and just answer questions for us, which we were just having, because he works for the BLM, and he can answer any of those questions with respect to the federal forest stuff. So do you want to – we'll let you go first.
Okay. All right. I'm Fred Shipley. I represent Oregon Mycological Society and the board of directors. We were identified – we got contacted about 10 days ago about this bill, SB 578. I have not seen
– Oh, your name, too.
Fred Shipley.
Thanks, Fred.
I'm sorry about that. So I don't know the content of the Dash 1 amendment at all.
I'm sorry about that.
So everything I've prepared for is the original. It's a little bit cumbersome here. You have a copy. I sent this to Rachel, so you can go through it at your leisure. I'm not going to read the whole thing.
Okay.
It gives you a background of who we are, what we are doing. We're actively out there, and we rub elbows with commercial and everybody else. So we share the... Oh, thank you. But the thing I would like to make sure is clear is that we are not just focusing on the edible, but we deal with Hypogeus. Hypogeus, we're looking at the fungal kingdom, and that is our interest. At the end of the day, we like to roast up some mushrooms. I try to structure the thing such that to make sure that there was consensus, there was cooperativeness, and trying to get the things complex. Looking at the... this is all in regards really coming back down to 164813 and how it impacts the commercial, recreational. And my point has been that when we have legislature, we need to do cause and do our essence. I think you were bringing it up, Senator. We need time to do it right. And the thing that I really oppose is it's called unintended consequences. You usually know the ones we have been addressing. By God, we didn't know that was going to happen. And then it is in rules. And this case I want to take right now is the situation of the 164813-5A. It is the exclusion of the permit process by having 1 gallon of anything less than a gallon is basically a permit. And that's a noble idea, and I appreciate the understanding of why it happened. I also know the testimony in 1993 and 1995 that got us to that point. People were saying, well, anybody that was carrying over a gallon of mushrooms must be a commercial picker. That is not the case, and it's unfortunately that testimony was given. But with this, back to what we're trying to do here is that I see nothing in the bill right now that protects the recreational. When you look at the administrative rules and how they're going to define what the rates are, what's going to be, there is no differentiation between commercial and recreation. Maybe Dash 1 has that in it, I don't know. But at the time I went through it, I did not see it. And I also know that with a measure, if you want to prohibit something, it needs to be in the body of the measure. If it's left to an administrative rule, eventually administrative rule will be able to define it such that it fits into whatever scope they want to. Their difficulties are when it's put in the legislature and it's part of a measure. And that's what's happened here with this one bill. But the point I'd like to make here is on the right now we have a situation here where you can go off and get, well, the point is I was going to make of this situation is that we're husbanding resources. We want to be sustainable. We want to basically encourage our membership and anybody else to go carpooling. The way the structure of the language is right now is that I can go out in my vehicle, I can harvest 1 gallon or less than 1 gallon at that point, and the state warden can stop. And I have been stopped by these people in the Tillamook property saying, by the way, you are aware of the 1 gallon rule. So it's not something that is just a piece of paper. They will do that, and it's at their discretion. And that's fine. Now, if my wife and I go out, we can basically gather 1 gallon. If my two kids come out with my wife, you can gain 1 gallon. Because of the wordage of that particular section, which is cutting and transport, transport has been defined as a vehicle. Vehicle has been defined down through the situation. So all of a sudden, when you say, well, there's four of us, we ought to have 4 gallons. That's a reasonable situation at that point. What has happened is they said, no, we're bound by the law. It's transport. Transport's a vehicle. You are only allowing, and I'm afraid we're going to have to arrest you, or what are they going to do? So that is the piece of the cautionary note I'm trying to make today about whatever we're going to do on a fast track, is that we make sure that we at least understand the implications of the of all the rules that we do. I'm not against 570. I believe in permits. We go through the vast array that we have of how to make sure that it's done. I just want to make sure that the net result of what the image has been given to you about the results of if we pass 578 and if we make the permits and we make the commercials pay the accordingly, what is the impact? Are you really achieving what you have set out to do, which is to husband the resource? Or is it going to be another set of rules out there that are unenforceable because there's no money? And without some sort of objective quantification about what is this revenue going to do, the Forest Service, I think, and BLM, they're going to look at you and say, we're strapped. Where does it come from? Yes, you gave us some money, but it's not enough to be effective. And if we're going to make a law, let's make it effective law. So I think I'll just close right there from the standpoint that, in conclusion, OMS appreciates and supports activities that encourage sustainability of all our natural resources and feel that the intent of the sponsors is consistent with our view. However, we are cautious about creating unfunded mandates, creating legislation that has unintended consequences without adequate due diligence of the impact of such legislation without some sunset clause embedded. We would support SB 578 if the facts uncovered through due diligence showed merit of cause.
Any questions before we? Okay. And so I guess what you've heard here is what we have a whole bunch of different rules that govern it, depending on what land you happen to be on. And I guess yes. You're here because you can tell us what's true with the federal BLM lands.
Yes, right? My name is Ron Exer, and I work for the Salem BLM. Worked there since 1985, and I've part of my job is I've sold mushroom permits to some of these people out here, and I pick them. I'm part of a mycology clubs as well, and I've written a couple of publications as well. And so what we do, each BLM district kind of has their own set of rules. Tillamook Resource Area doesn't sell any commercial permits at all. Eugene might give them the whole map of the resource area and say, here you go. The way my resource area in Lincoln, Benton, and Polk County operates, we used to let pickers pick 3 sections to harvest mushrooms in, and they would always pick the same 3 over and over and over. And so we just developed a map with about 10 sections, 1 mile per section, and we sell permits that might have those 10 on there and all the other area of BLM lands. And in the case of my resource area, 125,000 acres is open up to what we'd call a ma and pop, people out picking 1 gallons of mushrooms. And so the thing that we run into the most is selling permits. And let me back up a little bit. The BLM sells mushroom permits by the pound. And we have rules that the BLM charges 10% of the shed costs. So we call up the mushroom buyers. They say they're paying $2.50 a pound for mushrooms. We're going to charge the buyer or the picker 25 cents. And we issue them a permit. Each person has to have their own permit, because we used to put one person on a permit, and they'd have a carload, and they'd buy 200 pounds, and they'd have their permit good for 2 weeks. And so really it was just a license to pick every day until the 2 weeks was up. They'd go to the expiration date. We used to have load tickets. And so for each load ticket, it might be 10 pounds, and a person buys 200 pounds, they'd have 20 tickets, but the person would never fill out the load ticket. And the problem with enforcing the rules is really law enforcement. There's too many people out there picking, and there's not enough law enforcement. And I believe that's what you'll run into with the permit system. Is it was just there's no way to enforce it really.
So when they do the permit, do they does the buyer send you the money, or do you get the money at the time you're selling it with an assumption they're going to pick that many pounds?
Yeah, they usually sell permits one day a week. I use on Thursdays, and they line up out the door, and they come in, and they purchase. Like I say, the BLM purchases it or sells it by the pound. If they want 200, 500 pounds, and okay. We sell them, and the BLM collects the money right there. And then, okay. Then they usually get, we give them 1 to 2 weeks, depending on how many pounds they purchase, and depending on our knowledge of the availability of the fruiting bodies out in the woods.
Okay.
So I would like to point out that you're making rules for these organisms, and make sure that you understand the organisms you're making rules for, because some fruit in the fall, some in the spring, some of the mushrooms that are they're having problems over right now, along the coastal strip, or more down south. I don't see those problems yet in Benton, Lincoln, and Polk County, and that's where I'll base my knowledge from is the Oregon Coast Range.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you.
Oh,
yes.
One. So in your district, how many pounds a year do you think is harvested? I know it's kind of hard to, some of that's hard to track, but just take a stab at it.
I'd say there's probably about between 300 and 400 permits times 100 pounds.
100 pounds? Okay. Thank you.
30,000?
Okay. That's 1,000 pounds, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, we have ODF. Do you have any numbers on your permits? Yeah, come on up and we'll get that information before we go back to the pros and cons.
Okay.
Yes.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Liz Dent, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm the Deputy Division Chief for the State Forest Division. So I did a little research to figure out what's been going on state forests over the recent years, and we basically, our permit system is real similar to BLM, so we allow for free personal use up to 1 gallon, and then it's a $100 permit for 1,000 pounds and $100 more for each successive 1,000 pounds. And there's a limited duration that the permit is good, so it requires re-upping. And then we have several requirements under our directives around addressing some of the concerns around litter being left behind and people blocking access to roads and parking in areas for a long time. So all that's in our directives. Most of the picking permits are from our Forest Grove District. And from there, we had last year 120 permits. And that was for a revenue of $4,700. But that revenue is distributed with our split with the counties, so roughly 63% going to the counties and helping to support the local taxing districts and schools.
Any questions? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the gross receipts again?
In terms of dollars, it was $4,700 last year.
$4,000. And how many people of your staff does it take to administer this?
Well, we have a person at the front desk, and so someone will come in and get a permit from the front desk and fill it out. It's an established permit. And so there's a different permit for no charge. They still need to have a permit, and it shows, you know, what is expected to comply with our directives, and then a more detailed permit for the commercial use.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. So next we have
description. It's not somebody that's
Jim Wells and John Joe Relator. They're both right there.
Jim and Joe.
Two more pounds.
Go ahead.
All right, I will. My name is Jim Wells. I am currently the controller of Southern Oregon Select Fruit and Vegetable Company in Southern Oregon. It's a pear growing and packing operation. Used to be a co-op, growers co-op, started in 1930. Before that, I've done many things. Right before that, I was what many called, and I considered myself, the leading Oregon truffle specialist. I could say the world's leading, because anybody outside of Oregon would have a hard time having that title. Not the leading scientist, truffle scientist by any means. That honor rightfully belongs to others, Jim Trappi foremost at the OSU, nor necessarily the leading harvester. That there are several candidates could probably be that, and John Getz would certainly be one. Depends how you'd measure it. But a specialist. And before that, I was the director of fresh operations for Eugene Wild Mushroom Company and developed their fresh mushroom program. I was a pioneer, maybe the first to grade mushrooms, produce graded mushrooms and deliver them like regular produce to restaurants and order and delivery systems. For that, I was bioregional farmer, non-commercial, and for 15 years in McKinsey Bridge, growing most of my own food, and in that lifestyle is when I learned to pick mushrooms. Before that, I was on the road as a produce entrepreneur with my own produce truck up and down the West Coast, pioneered the distribution of organic produce in the Pacific Northwest, and I was, as part of that lifestyle later in the mountains, I learned to pick mushrooms as part of that to feed myself, and I was for a while the leading commercial harvester of morels in the Metolius area. I have a couple degrees from the University of California, Irvine, in biology and chemistry, with 2 years independent research in organic chemistry, synthesis of bioorganic compounds. So I've done a number of different things, including those. In my produce business and in my mushroom picking career and in as a distributor of mushrooms, one theme that has been consistent through that is my outlaw character. And being as intelligent as I am, I can game every one of the rules that now exist and have. I'm probably the only person to successfully demand and receive back confiscated morel mushrooms very quickly from the U.S. Forest Service from knowing the rules. I have been a longtime advocate for allowing free access to the commons for the populace. I have never broken any rules that I felt were reasonable and appropriate. I entirely agree with the sentiment that I heard recently that if we're going to do any kind of rules and legislation or anything of that matter, that it ought to be intelligent, it ought to be with a full knowledge of the subject matter, they ought to be effective, they ought to work. I also happen to have spearheaded and caused quite a phenomenon up the McKinsey River regarding the South Fork, use of the South Fork of the McKinsey, in a community that for 3 decades can be described on the McKinsey River as being 27 cliques. And through cooperation with the Forest Service there, we engaged in a 3-day collaborative brainstorming process and began to get all those 27 cliques to speak in one voice, and it was a miracle, the outcome that occurred. From those kinds of experiences, I know that that can be done, and I have heard many things in this room that are the reflections of things that I've heard over the decades. I'm absolutely confident that common ground can be found and a good working group process can meld all those interests and separate the wheat from the chaff. There's a great deal of hyperbole that has already been presented at these microphones today. Understandably so. People have strong emotions. They have personal motivations. They have economic motivations. They also have fears. And those all need to be addressed. I know it can. Now, I could talk about all these subjects for a long time, and I'm certainly not going to do that today. That would be inappropriate. You can ask me questions about it now or later, any of these things, but I want to touch on some things. I have come to the position, and I told you about me being an outlaw, partly because I came to a place a number of years ago that I concluded that the only, and this was mainly spurred by, crystallized around dealing with Oregon truffles. Oregon truffles being a species that requires soil disturbance in order to harvest. So therefore, the potential for environmental damage is great. The potential for product going to the market is great, et cetera. I came to the conclusion that the only possible way in our culture and given the landscape to professionalize the wild mushroom industry, and particularly Oregon truffles, was through a licensing process. The only model that we have that is consistent with all the rest of our legal and cultural values and precedents. I do believe that a licensing process will lessen the need for other costs, like other permits. I do believe the licensing process can lessen the need for law enforcement actions by our regular law enforcement people. I could talk about why I think so in specifics at another time, or today later, but not right now. But I absolutely do believe that is an outcome. Not necessarily. It can be done poorly. It can certainly, we all know that. That's easy to do. Easy to make poor rules and ineffective rules. But I do believe it can be done, and I do believe that's the outcome. The one thing about licensing, however, that I do want to mention, that does indeed speak to the issue of professionalizing the activity, is easily seen in analogy to other licensed activities, like, let's say, electricians. When a person goes through any kind of educational process, when a person has to demonstrate that they actually understand the subject matter, if a person is given information that they have to absorb and demonstrate they know, that tells them what is reasonable, appropriate, safe, professional, desired conduct in their profession, and they've invested their time in that, and they've received a certification that says they got it, they are much, much, much more likely to apply it. They have an investment in it. They're a professional. They are going to more likely do it. And so nothing 100% is going to do away with or you know, ensure that we're not going to have any bad actors or any bad actions from good actors. But, of course, what we're after is minimizing it in the most efficient way we can do it, the most effective way we can do it. And I think that's what licensing can do for us. I want to speak to the misidentification and poisoning. Yes, there have been.
Go fairly quickly.
Yes, I will. There have been people there have been poisoning cases. I can point you to the documentation of that. I have a friend, Todd Spanier, the head of a mushroom company in California, that had that happen with product that he sold to Whole Foods. And as a result of that, he engaged with some high-level California poison control and ag department individuals hosting meetings at his place for months, where they worked out protocols for mushroom poisoning responses. And they also came up, so that the record of that whole meeting process and what they talked about and what they would do in the future, if they, you know, what the next steps would be, are all available to this committee, I'm absolutely sure. Okay. It is true. It is not that just out-of-state harvesters contain people who have behaviors that we might want to be addressing. All right, it exists. It has nothing to do with what your race is, where you live, et cetera. It has more to do with your culture, what you believe, what your worldview is, and how you're going to apply it, and how much respect you have for other people. So you know, whatever we do has to be applied uniformly. It should cover all types of people. All right, money does leave Oregon. A lot of it stays here. I could name you, let's see, I think eight was the phrase I heard from somebody, companies in Oregon. I could name you eight companies outside of Oregon, and a lot of them take a huge amount of mushrooms out of Oregon. All right. I think I'll leave it at that. I certainly am open to, available if you have any questions.
Yeah.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, my name's Joe Rollator. I'm the person that the first three people that talked, Al King, John Getz, and Jack Karczynski, contacted to do the kind of day-to-day work on this, and I brought this issue to the chair, and I imagine he's very glad that I did.
Yes.
So I would ask the chair that this obviously is an idea that a lot of people have interest in. They've come here to talk to you. And so although there is a lot of controversy and difference of opinion, if you could get us together for a work group and maybe give us a little bit of guidance, we might be able to come back here with something that you could all pass. And I that's my only request. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Any questions? Nope. Thank you both. We'll probably be getting a hold of you.
Thanks.
So next we have Rex Swoss Zinder. Wait, these long names are hard for me. So I'm going to say Rex. Arlie Smith and Mike. Oh, Dyson. Yeah. Come on up.
Thank you.
And again, we've got a little while. We've got one more bill, so if you can keep it relatively short, it's helpful. But you can go first.
My name is Rex Schwarzenjuber, and
thank you. You said that better than I. I appreciate that.
I have I've been a commercial truffle collector or mushroom collector since 1980, and a commercial truffle collector since 1990. I've bought and sold mushrooms and truffles. And I've also done work for 6 years building species inventory lists for the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service. And I have seen a lot of forest. I spend my time on the ground. You know, when we first started digging truffles, and I think, you know, really most of this is about truffles. When we first started digging truffles, the land managers came out and they just said they were shocked. It looks like, you know, they're standing in trees that are 12 to 18 years old, and it's the only there's absolutely nothing growing underneath these trees. They're monoculture, and because the way that the harvest of these trees is now on industrial forest land is every 35 years the trees will be removed. And so really the only species that are going to be able to exist in the, under these conditions are the species that live in the first 35 years of the stand of the trees. And truffles are one of those things. And what you see is there's harsh digging from people who don't have any idea what they're doing. And then there's people who I had some land leased for over 10 years, and you know, I took care of that land. I made sure that the truffles, I collected the truffles that were out there, and that when the weather conditions were right, I took care, I made sure the beds were in good enough shape when the weather conditions were right, those truffles were fruiting. And I've also seen areas that were, before Weyerhaeuser bought out Willamette Industries, we had a tacit agreement with the land managers at Willamette. I jokingly went in and asked to buy a permit from one of the land managers that I had seen out in the woods several times collecting truffles and mushrooms, and he joked and said, "Well, hand me $20,000 and we'll talk about it." Well, $20,000 is kind of ridiculous at that point because he didn't have any money. But really, what he told us to do was continue doing what we're doing. Now, it's become a problem because there have been, you know, there's been an increase in truffle buyers that don't have any ground, they don't have any land, they don't have any, they just have, they just put up a sign and put up money, and people will bring them in their truffles. And that's really not the way to do this. But imposing a new bureaucracy is not really tax. It's not a good use of our tax money to do this, because my best estimate of the amount of truffles that were sold in Oregon between November and January of this year, if there was 3,600 pounds sold, I would be absolutely shocked. I mean, really. So what are we really talking about? We've heard land managers talk about $4,000 worth of revenue, and we've heard another land manager talk about selling 40,000 pounds of mushrooms. And then, you know, I really can't see where we have any cultivated truffles produced in Oregon. Maybe there are some in the last year or so, but we had zero cultivated truffles in Oregon before 3 years ago. You know, this is a bill that has, this is a solution for no problem. We have existing law enforcement. We have existing rules that if law enforcement were to actually pursue them exactly in the way that another person brought up here at this meeting, that we wouldn't even be having this problem. We wouldn't be having this conversation. And I would never support this bill without the requirement that the landowners issue permits, because this is just exclusion of people from the woods. Because if you're saying, okay, this person, you can't be anywhere out and you can't reach down and pick up a mushroom, you know, how are people supposed to, you know, that's part of being walking out of the woods is like reaching out and pick a mushroom. Like you can even go on Forest Service land and pick 5 mushrooms without having a permit or anything like that, just because it's incidental to your use. Now, if you go out and you actually pursue the mushrooms, you know, permits are required. And I do buy permits, and I am concerned about the stewardship of the mushrooms out there, because I rely on these mushroom patches every year. I can go to the same truffle patches that I have gone to since 1992, as long as they're still in existence, and I could get truffles unless there's a few areas where they die out. You know, they change according to the standard of the trees, but if those trees have been harvested, there are no truffles there. Yeah. And I guess that's and as far as the issue of people misidentifying mushrooms, this particular bill will not stop the individual person from just going out and grabbing something that looks like a patty straw mushroom that's an amanita, that's a deadly amanita, because that's an education issue.
Thank you.
My name is Arlie Smith. I have a company in Portland. I've been in business with wild mushrooms now for about 25 years or maybe a few more. 20 years ago, we attempted to start a Special Forest Products Association. We worked with the Forest Service, with state entities, and eventually, we were only told that management, we were looking for a broad background and way of doing things that would make everyone happy. And we never did get that, needless to say. But we did get licenses.
Right.
And so we've lived with licenses. And a few years ago, we had more licenses put in place. And we've lived with those, and it seems to be my observation that those have been fairly efficient. Now, I'm going to go off track just a little bit here, because I think it's only in fairness to the panel that they understand a broader picture of what's been said here today than what you have right now. First of all, sustainability of mushrooms is basically a thing that's up to Mother Nature. They've been here forever. They all have the same function, and that is to eat things that have been alive or are still living. And that is the bottom line. That's what they do. They will be in an area, and they will stay in that area until they're out of food. And then they're not there anymore, unless they're dormant and waiting for another food supply. So with that understood, you can see why sustainability is a very easy thing to trust in our industry, and I've seen it for many years as that very thing. They will come back. This last fall and winter has been one of the worst years I've ever seen. It was strictly because of Mother Nature, not any human actions or anything that happened on that note. I didn't come here really to talk about verpa mushrooms, but I believe I might as well, being that I was one of the first people to introduce those into the marketplace. And I did so because, primarily, for two things. First of all, I grew up in Northeast Oregon, born and raised, and we harvested verpa mushrooms. My father took me with him, and we harvested those and ate them when I was a child. They grow along the rivers, basically, and around the ponds and such, primarily under cottonwoods, but they can grow on thorn bushes and so on and so forth. Most people still don't know them as a true morel, which they were classified as a true morel for many, many years, until scientists found that their spore sac had more spores in them, and they were slightly different shaped and colored. So that's when they put them out of the morel family and into the verpa family, which there is another verpa mushroom that grows in the mountains as well, and it's not considered as harmful as verpa bohemica. But on the second note of the harmfulness of verpa bohemica, when I realized that there was a question and an outcry from people in the industry about this market being marketed, I did some homework. And my homework consisted of getting in contact with the North American Mycological Association, which is a database for all mushroom incidences in North America, including Canada and Mexico. I asked them about verpa mushrooms. They said, yes, we have some instances on our books. We have 4 instances at that time. This was a few years ago. I said, can you tell me what they're about? And he did. He said, yes, these people got ill. No one died. And I said, well, what were the results of that then? What did you what came from that? And they said, we couldn't really decide because they had either consumed other mushrooms with them or alcohol or both. Then I got smart and I asked them, well, what about true morels? What do you got on your books for true morels? His answer to me, page fulls of incidences, not just 3 or 4. So what to me that means is just what the other fellow said, that incidences in mushrooms, unless you just get the wrong one, can be a personal body chemistry thing where you react and no one else does that consumes them. I actually had a friend that couldn't eat the white button mushrooms, even cooked. So there's many different reasons for these fears to be put into people still. And what we saw in the days of early marketing in this mushroom was the fact that they sold at a lower price than true morels. There weren't a lot of true morels at the time because, and that's why we call these the early morel. But the true morels might be going for $50 a plate in a restaurant, and the early morels might be going for $25 a plate. Now, who are you going to hear from? Another example of private interests is the timber companies and the truffles. I would say, from what I know, a large percentage of the truffles come from private timberland. I have a harvest permit with Weyerhaeuser, a contract. So I'm aware of the process and what goes into that. But, it's not a state problem. It's a timber company problem on timber company land where they get tax subsidies for. And they have to provide the enforcement that it takes to do things right. People can get permits. People may not get permits. But regardless, they're still going to have to make a bigger effort on taking care of their own property. There's quite a few questions in the way this is written in my mind. First of all, there's several species that are wild, but they are cultivated also. So what is it going to cost to train people to know the difference? That's a factor that has to be taken into consideration. Because I may be driving down the road with a basket full of oyster mushrooms that I bought from someone in Salem, and I may get pulled over and ticketed for having wild mushrooms because the gentleman doesn't know the difference. There's many mushrooms now, more and more all of the time. The scientific side of things is progressing in cultivation of mushrooms, of the same ones that grow wild. They don't always look the same. They don't always taste the same, but they're the same species. So that has to be taken into consideration. And those costs, I think you're just seeing the very tip of the iceberg, because the costs aren't just going to be covered by licenses and permits. The costs are way beyond that, way beyond that. There was a separate bill a few years ago that came basically to the same position of attention in the state. And it just so happened that some of the people that were involved in that testimony were law enforcement. They were asked if they had enough people to enforce that law if it passed. They said, no way. No way, dude. Is there enough law enforcement to enforce this law that if you pass it? The other thing is, we need management. We don't need licenses. We've already been through that. We didn't get any management out of the Forest Service licenses. We've always asked for a voice of our industry. The rest of the world has traded mushrooms for centuries. We're about in our 30th, 35th year, something like that, on a commercial level. Management. Working together so that things get done that needs to get done to get the illegal and improper things out of the picture. It'll make the state stronger. It'll make management stronger and the industry stronger. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. You've heard a lot of varying opinions today. It's everybody's pretty passionate, obviously, about the subject. Our members are as well, too. From our point of view, is the BLM has a permit process already. The Forest Service has a permit process already. You heard from the Department of Forestry, they have a permit process already. So it appears to me this permit process, what's left, is managed private property, so a state permitting process on private property. Our forest landowners already heard, you've heard from a number of people talking about contracts, permits. This would basically kind of take the landowner's ability to regulate their own programs on their own lands. So we're here today to say we'd be more than willing to participate in a work group and talk about some things, look for some common ground, but we would definitely at this point in time not support the bill or the Dash 1 amendments. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this group? Thank you. And our last panel then is Lars Norgan, Roger Beyer, and it looks like Matt Briggs. And we'll probably have 3 or 4 minutes apiece if we can, so we can get our other bill out today. So go ahead.
Okay, my name is Lars Norgren. I was born in Corvallis in 1959, graduated from Corvallis High School in 1976, Reed College in 1984. I got a personal connection with a forestry school at OSU. You know, I was never a student there. My father went elk hunting with professors there. And so I have an academic background in forestry. I own 40 acres of timberland. The first three speakers to this group are fighting the battles of 20 years ago. All of the issues they addressed were in the media in the early 90s. They've been resolved. You know, they're unhappy about going out in the woods and seeing other pickers. Those pickers were there in droves 20 years ago. They're still there. They haven't gotten that much more abundant. I am the person with the roadside stand selling Verpa bohemica. I didn't sell it for 5 years because literature led me to believe it was dangerous. I discovered hundreds of people face-to-face that ate it with no ill results. As Arlie pointed out, thousands of people a year get very sick eating black morels. I'm sure Jack serves them in his restaurant all the time. There are people who are allergic to black morels. I'll leave it to other people to tell you about Jack's bona fides as a mycologist and a cook, but there are many restaurants in Portland that serve more wild mushrooms in a year than he served in his life. So misidentification is never, ever a worry of mine. I'm worried that someone over the mountain is paying less than I am, and I'll have a competitive advantage over me. I know that everyone in the rest of the world is paying less than I am. In 1992, I was driving from here to Mendocino County and back twice a week. The mushrooms that we picked in Mendocino County could be purchased in San Francisco from Portugal for less money than the picker in Mendocino County was getting. It's a global industry. It has been declining in the state of Oregon. The public seems to be more and more interested, have more and more perception of the mushroom industry, but it has been in decline. The number of acres harvested, you name it. Vast areas that produced mushrooms in the past have been clear cut. And so the supply is reduced. The price in absolute dollars today is the same as it was 20 years ago. You know the pickers' gas money has gone up. Their rent has gone up. They're really being squeezed. So as people have pointed out, the site-specific permits for mushroom picking, you can't legally pick without a permit. That's already taken care of. In terms of identifying the mushrooms, the chefs know what they're doing. As Mr. Pine pointed out, the state of Oregon, Department of Health came up with a rule last year. Whenever a restaurant buys mushrooms, there's a paper trail. It's got to be a latinate binomial for each species delivered, contact information of the seller. That's been taken care of. We are like 48th in the nation for funding of public education. We're way down there for public safety. We have very high auto insurance premiums in the state because of the lack of highway patrol. We can't fund a mushroom program. The amount of money in the mushroom industry is declining. It's not a cash cow. This is just a serious misperception. People say there's trouble in mushroom land. All of these things were in the papers in the early 90s about the violence. America is a violent country. We're full of gun nuts. Mushroom pickers are very peaceful. You hear about one case of domestic violence in a mushroom picking camp. It's like all the, it's just nonsense. So I just don't see that any problem exists right now that needs to be addressed by this bill. The industry is regulated every bit as well as it needs to be. In terms of compacting the soil, it encourages mushroom fruiting. It's very bad for Douglas fir. That's why big timber companies use high lead logging. They pick the tree up. They never touch the ground. They leave that soil loose so the tree will grow. But if you find a deer trail where the soil's been compacted, the mushrooms come up and they're thicker. If you find selective logging where a caterpillar tractor goes in and removes the logs, they'll be chanterelles cheek by jowl. The compaction encourages the fruiting of the mushrooms. Again, as a landowner with 40 acres of timber, I don't want caterpillar tractors driving around my land because of the way that affects the tree's growth. But the mushrooms fruit heavier. A unpaved road where road graders go, I found many times large amounts of mushrooms coming up through the shoulder of that heavily packed road. No amount of human foot traffic will ever equal the compaction of that machinery. The mushrooms are almost all symbionts. That's a slight mistake on Arlie's point. Chanterelles, porcini, truffles, matsutake, all of these mushrooms are incapable of living without the tree. Ectomycorrhizae is an organism shared by the mushroom, the mycelia of the mushroom. The body of the mushroom is like cobwebs underground. Think of that as an apple tree buried in the ground. The mushrooms are the fruit. You cannot over-harvest mushrooms. Lorelei Norvell was in the Oregon Mycological Society, did a doctoral dissertation for 10 years for the University of Washington studying, does harvesting impact chanterelles? Absolutely not. But because the chanterelle, the truffle, you name it, is attached to the roots of a host tree, the biology and the life cycle of a tree has everything to do with productivity. You don't find any of these mushrooms under 5 or 10-year-old trees. You'll find white truffles under 20-year-old trees. By the time the tree is 40 or 50 years old, the white truffles have been replaced by black truffles. When someone says, oh, I picked mushrooms there and got lots, and then people came and trampled the ground, and they never came back, the trees are getting older. There's a window of opportunity. When the tree is young and it's producing immense amounts of surplus carbohydrates, you have the potential to get immense amounts of mushroom fruits. As the trees get older, that stops. The whole future of the industry is threatened by the future of the forest. As you're talking about Swiss needle cast coming up next. The Douglas fir is the main host of the chanterelle. Swiss needlecast is, you know, a huge problem for the state. No one's talking about it. Well, you're not going to get chanterelles if Swiss needlecast is affecting the host. You know, Starker Forest owns 25% of Benton County, and they quit planting Douglas fir 20 years ago. You clear cut, you're going to lose the chanterelles. That's something that's never going to be dealt with, you know, in this forum. So in terms of sustainability, it's just absolute nonsense. The pickers aren't having any impact on the harvest. They leave trash. Well, deer hunters and elk hunters can leave trash. You know, other tourists. These, all of the arguments you heard at the beginning of this thing are absolutely spurious. And this permitting process is going to do nothing but be revenue negative. They just can't possibly collect enough revenue from the existing economy to pay for any new people, any kind of permit, you know, system. So Forest Grove is where I live. I buy mushrooms there. And they said $4,700.
Well, I'll let you wrap up because we've only got a couple more minutes. Before
yeah, but I think it gives you a pretty good idea of the small amount of revenue that's being made through the permit process right now. Yeah. And it's often too much. Frequently, the pickers can't sell their mushrooms at all. As I said, the price is typically the same as it was 20 years ago. But frequently, they can't sell them at all. It's a commodity.
Our next one.
My name's Matt Briggs. You hear me?
Yep. And you don't need to be too close to the mic.
Sorry. I'll back off.
Yep.
I've run a wild mushroom business since 1981. A lot of the people and quite a bit of wild mushroom company executives. I think this is the first time we've seen each other in 20 years. We're just competing against each other here. What I wanted to say, Lars did such a good job, I'm going to leave a bunch of stuff out. But in rebuttal to the earlier witnesses who did this, made their pitch, I think the Florence area, where Mr. Goetz is from, has a particular problem with dunes-related matsutake mushrooms that have very thin filaments out in the dunes, and they took care of this a long time ago by only having 100 permits to pick in a year, as I understand it. So they've limited the amount, and this is with all the, but they have bootloads of four-wheel drive buggies flying over, cutting these things. Anyway, so that's one thing. Truffles is a whole nother ball game as far as disturbed soil. But Lorelei also found out that the more you disturb soil with a lot of these mushrooms, the better they grow. The other thing about industrial camps, In 1989, when we started doing the matsutake harvest up on top of Central Oregon, might have been 3,000 people up there. And gradually over time, pretty much due to global warming, in my view for sure, the amount of fruiting of matsutake, which is a cold shock mushroom, has to be cold for it to come up, sap coming down from the trees, is going down pretty rapidly. The other thing that's happening up there to lower that is that kind of make work, clear the woods stuff for loggers who are out of work are clearing all the understory, and that's some of the main areas for matsutake to grow. But at any rate, the amount of camps, instead of 2,000 or 3,000, are 50, 100. It's 10 times less pickers up there than there used to be. And I know Jack came here in the 90s. He didn't see what it was before, what it is now. I think people are more mobile now. They shift around to different stuff. But I don't see any problem with too many pickers, with compaction, with over-harvest. As far as training for this goes, I would agree with Jack. From what I know, different people about Lars might know more, but I heard in the old days it was about a 14% sensitivity to this Verpa bihemica. The jack-o'-lantern that I've heard about, it's like chanterelles, is more up in Alaska than here, some in California. One that I've been concerned about is a corcora egg that some people are selling, which resembles something that can be quite dangerous. But I've talked to 3,000 people in the FDA about problems with identification and this and that. And what I would say is that people who are in this business go through this in 7 or 8 layers. You've got the picker, the buyer, the trucker, the packer, the foreman, me, a wholesaler, a restaurant sous chef, the eater, and there are very, very, very few incidents of this. And the reason that wild mushrooms are commercial is that they don't look like things that are dangerous. That's why they're commercial worldwide. And that's why matsutake is harvested, pulled, so that you don't see a bulb on the bottom of it, which is a relative amanitis. And the Japanese will not buy a cut matsutake for that reason. So I would say, the other thing I'd like to say is about paperwork. This one-page paperwork, Section 2 of this bill. We have this paperwork already in the state of Oregon since 1993, and in my view, it is the data from it has never been collected. It's never been used. The only reason it's used is to go to a buy station and to see if people are filling it out. No one's ever tracked anything back. Sometimes the police check and see if somebody's on this list that they're looking for another police activity. But I would say that this whole, I would say already for 20 years we've been filling out paperwork that nobody uses. Why add on another level of this? This is one page of stuff for every transaction. Imagine if you did that for every transaction you did. That's what we do. So I would actually repeal the 1993 bill as of paperwork to be filled out because it does nothing. Why add to it? Enough for me today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Been in contact and conversations with the proponents of the bill, and my members would tell you that there is a problem that has come up recently with the harvest of truffles. That's our interest in this. There is illegal truffle harvesting going on private property, and under the current law, truffles are not included under the current law because truffles are not a mushroom, apparently. They are a fungus but not a mushroom. Therefore, they are not considered a special forest product. We are interested in fixing that. My understanding is that this bill, the relating to clause, may be too tight in order to fix that. So we're working with proponents to either get that dealt with. If we can't do it here, we hope to have another bill that we can do it there. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to be working with the, all sides on the issue and hope to be back in front of you in some way, shape, or form.
Is there any questions for this panel?
Seeing.
Oh, yes.
Comment.
Roger, you can keep me in the loop as to what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Seeing no other, thank you. And that. Is there anybody else out there that wants to talk about
fungi?
Fungi? Come on up for a second. You've already had one time, but we'll give you
no. Mr. Chair,
we probably shouldn't. You'll talk to us offline.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
We'll have you. We'll talk to you offline. We're going to close this hearing.
So where do you take the written?
Yeah, always right there. So I think we'll talk to you later. All right, not tonight. Okay, thank you. We're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 578. And we only have one person, and we want to just get something started. We're probably going to do a work group on Senate Bill 715. So, and if people have to leave, they can. But we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 715. And with that, Doug and Liz, if you want to come up from the Department of Forestry, and you can talk a little about what this bill is, just so we know what it is we're talking about. Very cool.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 715 requires harvesting in the Tillamook State Forest and Forest in areas exhibiting moderate to extreme Swiss needle cast disease. It requires replanting with trees resistant to Swiss needle cast disease, and it specifies the harvest and replanting is to be completed as soon as practicable, but no later than January 2nd, 2018.
Thank you. With that.
Okay, very good. Good afternoon, Chair Roland, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Becker. I'm Oregon State Forester and Director of the Department of Forestry. I'm joined by Liz Dent, the Deputy Chief of our State Forest Division. We're here today to provide you a little bit of background about Swiss needle cast, the Swiss needle cast disease in the Tillamook State Forest. We're going to talk a little bit about its scope, how we've addressed it, how we would characterize its current status, and kind of the remaining Swiss needle cast affected stands that we have on the Tillamook State Forest and some of the challenges and opportunities that they represent. I want to appreciate the focus of Senator Bertschegger and the sponsors on forest health, on timber sale revenues, on community well-being. All of these things are important to us. I appreciate the opportunity to have to address it here in this conversation. We have made significant progress aggressively getting after Swiss needle cast in the Tillamook State Forest, particularly over the last 10 years. And we currently continue to address affected Swiss needle cast stands on a regular basis as part of our ongoing operations. So for our brief presentation here today, I've asked Liz if she would tell you a little bit about Swiss needle cast, what it is, how we've responded to it on the Tillamook, a brief sense of the science on Swiss needle cast, as well as how we're addressing it on a regular basis as part of our operations. After Liz's comments, we'd be glad to take any questions that you have.
All right. So Liz Dent for the record, and I'll keep this brief given the hour of the day here. And so in summary, basically, Swiss needle cast is a native pathogen that affects all Douglas fir, and so it's just a matter of severity as far as how much the tree or stand is going to suffer. It affects the ability of the leaves to go through respiration, and so they essentially lose that ability, and the tree casts off its all of its needles except for the current year's growth. So that's the name, the needle cast in the name. It is native, and so the name, the terminology Swiss can be a little confusing, but it's a native pathogen here in Oregon. So as I said, it's endemic. It's everywhere. And it just so happens that the growing conditions that we have in the Tillamook State Forest are ideal for it to thrive. Also, we had a problem after the three major fires in the Tillamook State Forest of replanting with a seed source that was particularly receptive to the disease. So as Doug said, we've been aggressive at treating it. We've treated about 45% of the stands over the past 10 years, and our approach there is to do mostly clear-cut harvesting, but some stands do perform well, seem to perform well with thinning as well. So we keep that as sort of a tool in our toolbox. The practice after clear-cut harvesting is to replant the area with Douglas fir that are not as sensitive to the disease, that are resistant to the Swiss needle cast, or other species that are not affected by it at all, hemlock, western red cedar. That we've been fairly successful with that, and we keep a close relationship with Oregon State's College of Forestry to continue doing research on the issue of Swiss needle cast. An example of that is they've looked at, they've taken in several of our stands where we've measured the stand conditions, and they've done some modeling work and then looked at other factors that are affecting the ability of the disease to really cripple the stand's growth. And there are other factors, microclimate, slope, aspect, humidity is a big driver. So that's sort of how the disease works and how we're approaching it. In a nutshell, when we consider what stands we're going to harvest in a given year, we look at all of those characteristics about the Swiss needle cast, the stand age, is it ready for harvest, would it do best with clear cut or thinning, and then we have several other objectives we're trying to meet in our management of the forest and our harvest decisions, and so all those have to play in access, the terrain, what sort of logging operation is it going to take to actually get the trees harvested. So that hits on what the disease is, what we're doing around harvesting it, and our current approach, our current plan with Swiss needle cast is to continue to work to replace those stands with the Swiss needle cast resistant species versions of Douglas fir or different species altogether. These stands tend to have very low stocking, roughly about half the stocking level that we would expect to see on a normal, healthy Douglas fir stand. So the volume that we could harvest from these sites, we anticipate to be fairly low. They also tend to be what's left of the Swiss needlecast stands tends to be in areas that are hard to access. So the actual harvesting process for these stands is probably going to be fairly expensive and require more road building. So our approach to that is to keep them always in the mix and thinking as, you know, what our opportunities are to work those stands towards healthy Douglas fir stands or other species.
Okay. Question?
I think that, first of all, if we decide, I think we should have a work group on this, because I think what this bill is proposing is to accelerate that and maybe have a standalone program to, because of the low volumes and the high logging operation costs on these stands, that it would have to kind of stand alone and to accelerate this process. And that, but the bill obviously needs a lot of work to do to it to get there. And would you entertain doing a work group on this?
Chair Roblin, Senator Bertschinger, I definitely would like to, you know, we can definitely talk some more about how we've responded in the past and where the opportunities are. You know, just adding on one of the pieces that Liz had mentioned, you know, most of the stands that we have right now, we've got about 39,000 acres of Swiss needlecast affected stands. They're in the 10 to 30-year-old range. And that kind of helps put things in perspective. I think we're pleased to to work some more and talk some more about how we can address Swiss needlecast. And obviously, there's a volume and a value issue here in terms of making these worthwhile. But would be open to further conversation about that.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Liz, in your presentation on the first bullet that's on the letter that we received dated March 14th. It talks about the remaining areas include forest stands that are too young or small to generate revenue. Mm-hmm. My concern is, as you read on, it says unstable ground that is landslide prone. So if we went in, and I'm not sure, what I heard was more than likely clear cut is would be the option that would be chosen as compared to Selecta. I mean, what are we setting ourselves up to basically unstabilize the ground to the point of where we're going to have more problems, not knowing what the terrain is as to creeks, et cetera, right, and all that.
So Senator Prezansky, I appreciate the question. In short, we have several strategies in place that we would implement to minimize the potential to trigger landslides or to have negative effects on streams and water quality and everything. The challenge with the steep slopes is that many of them require greater logging expenses to actually implement the harvest units. If we, under the scenario, let's say, where we've determined we're going to do a harvest unit on some of these slopes and they have some landslide-prone terrain, we have a geotechnical engineer that comes and gives us advice about areas that we should leave trees to help address our landslide issues.
Great. Thank you for the clarification.
I don't want to, though, give the impression that we prevent all landslides with those.
I fully appreciate strategies. That. I think more for the record, we just want to make certain that we understand that there is a thought process and procedure that is followed before we actually just go in there.
Yep.
And understand you want to take care of the stands. They seem like the age that they are. It's a good age to be able to, let's say, clear it and replant and get some more productive.
Yeah, I mean, that's my biggest concern is if we've got these younger stands, they're going to grow very slowly because they've got needlecast. So you're going to not get much protection out of that land. And if they get a lot bigger, that is another reason we get landslides. The volume on the side of the hill can cause things. So is it better to get it out of there, even though we're not going to get a lot of market out of it, and get it replanted? And is there a chance to have a much healthier forest than leaving this one to grow intermittently? I mean, that's the question that I would have, the same kind of thing.
Thank you, Sean. Chair Roblin, I think one of the challenges here is kind of the value proposition associated with, you know, when we, so State Forest is an entirely self-funded enterprise. And so when we are out doing an operation, it has to obviously pay for itself, and then it returns a value back to the beneficiary. I think in cases like this, when for operating in areas where the logging costs are higher, where the value of the stand is lower, it raises a question about whether or not there's a value proposition there. I think, the other issue is in terms of trying to prioritize where we put our resources in terms of timber sale planning and actually doing the operations. There may be better ways for us to invest the resource and energy than converting, if you will, a 10 to 30-year-old tightly packed, slow-growing Douglas fir stand that's in a relatively inaccessible location. So that's kind of the push. The other side is that, you know, we also know that, especially in the North Coast, this is probably the best place in the world for trees to grow. And, you know, so there's a lost opportunity cost associated with those lands being tied up in lands that are in with trees that are Swiss needle cast affected. So it's a balancing.
Yeah, and I work because they also have a tendency to be more fire prone than do other places. So
a tighter pack stand.
And you don't need to have that going on in that forest either. So I appreciate it. Any other questions and we'll have Senator Bretscher check with them and see if there's some things we can talk about. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 715. And thank you for staying a few minutes longer and being a part of this. And I appreciate that from all of you. And we will close our public hearing, our meeting for the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. And we don't have any carryovers, so we're good, right?